We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. So starting out with local and the taxes and the King County Council. What's up with that?
Yeah, this week the King County Council voted on two proposed tax increases, an increase in the sales tax and an increase in the property taxes to go on the August ballot. Unfortunately, the vote was 5-4 in favor, which was one vote short of the 6 votes needed in order to pass these emergency measures and put them on the August ballot, so they will not go on the August primary ballot. But then the council, if it votes again in June or July, sometime in the next couple of months, it could include them, you know, with a simple majority vote on the November ballot. Now, the folks who voted against, this was kind of a surprise, you know, because Dow Constantine, the King County executive, assumed that he had the 6 votes because Reagan, Dunn, and Kathy Lambert had said that they would vote for the tax increases, but then they changed their minds at the last minute. It's interesting. They said that one of the reasons that they gave for changing their votes is that they wanted to see more information on what services would be cut out of the budget. In particular, Reagan Dunn said that he didn't want to see any cuts made to the King County Sheriff's Department or any sorts of police or emergency services. He wanted the cuts to come from the Metro bus services or other King County services. What I found kind of interesting is that he and Lambert both complained about how the county government spends a lot of money on salary increases for county employees. And what was very interesting about this is both Lambert and Dunn, and the other two, I think it was Von Reichbauer and Haig also.
And the Republicans on the council.
Yeah, the Republicans on the council also voted for some of these labor agreements, some of these packages that provided, for example, a 7% increase in salary for employees of the King County Sheriff's Department. So I find this kind of interesting that now that there's a budget crisis, they're complaining about the very labor contracts they voted to approve.
Well, this is posturing, and it's posturing for their base, because this way they can say they were opposed to tax increases, but and that they were trying to protect law enforcement. But then when they come out and say that they're questioning labor costs, people hear that and they hear labor, they hear unions.
Yeah.
What they don't hear is that most of those labor costs have to do with law enforcement, because law enforcement and the jails and judicial system are 75% of King County's budget at this point.
Yeah, and
because
the rest,
so much else has been cut to the bone.
Yeah, and the rest are really absolutely necessary services, and that includes the Metro bus system. And that's unfortunately where these guys want to see cuts come from.
All right, moving on. A new poll from the University of Washington.
Yeah, the University of Washington and Western Washington University professors and graduate students conducted a poll. They were interested in finding out how much support some of these upcoming ballot initiatives had with the general public. Of course, it's a little early. The campaign season for some of these things hasn't really even started. Most of them are still out gathering signatures. But it was kind of interesting to see that the tax initiative, number 1098, which can broadly be called the Tax on Rich People Initiative, is favored by about 58% to 30% of Washington residents.
In other words, almost 2-1 in favor as opposed to opposed.
Yeah, and I've noticed just kind of by observing on the street how signature gatherers are doing with this initiative that it is extremely popular. That people are signing it in droves.
Yeah, as is the marijuana decriminalization signature. That one's getting a lot of signatures too.
Yeah, and that one in the poll fared pretty good too. About 52% of Washington residents support that initiative to remove civil and criminal penalties for possession of small amounts of marijuana. And I also found interesting that about the same number of Washington residents support the liquor privatization initiative as well. which is kind of interesting. I think Jav pointed this out last night when I was talking to him on the phone. He said, "Oh, that's interesting, because if the state ever decides to legalize marijuana, the main distribution route would be through the state-owned and state-run liquor stores. So disappear."
Yeah, that's a decision that the state legislature would have to make. It's not part of the actual initiative that's going to hopefully be on the ballot in November.
Not this.
But if you want to have a distribution system, that would be the logical place to do it, and it'll be much more expensive to set up a brand new system if the current one is dismantled.
Yeah, and going back to the tax initiative 1098, the tax on rich people, what the poll also found was that the Tim Iman initiative that would require two-thirds vote of the state legislature to raise taxes gets something like a 60% approval rating, which I find kind of interesting, because basically what that means is Washington residents are saying, look, you know, we know who should be taxed. It's people who are benefiting the most from the way the system is set up. It's not us.
All right. Moving on, Dino Rossi making an official announcement this week.
Yeah, as was widely expected, Rossi threw his hat into the race for senator, trying to unseat three-term incumbent Patty Murray. And there are several particularly interesting pieces about this. The main focus of the August primary now for that race is going to be Rossi versus Clint Didier and some of the other lesser-known Republican candidates who've been trying to capture the Tea Party vote. The thing about this is Rossi was specifically recruited by the D.C. Republican establishment to run in this race. He may or may not be able to be competitive against Murray. Murray has a very good track record in her previous runs for office of beating well-funded Republican opponents. In fact, last time she beat George Nethercutt by 10%, and before that I believe she beat Linda Smith by 18, and she originally beat Rod Chandler in 1992, even though he vastly outspent her, and she beat him by nearly 10%. So she has done very well in statewide races. And Rossi's gonna have a lot of money from the National Republicans. He can raise a lot of money in a hurry. Murray already has $10 million in the bank, but Rossi is really not who a lot of the Tea Partiers want to see get the nomination. The anti-incumbent mood may well be an anti-establishment mood, in which case you're going to see a little bit of internecine fighting within the ranks of the Republicans for who can face off against Murray this summer. The particular weak point that Rossi has in this race is that he represents business as usual. And in particular, aside from the fact that he has lost two statewide races and not particularly graciously at that, his other potential weak point is what's been happening since he ran for governor twice, which is that he has made an awful lot of money off of real estate, which of course is his day job, when he has one. And, but he in particular has done a lot of profiting off of the housing bubble and off of real estate, speculation, off of foreclosures, and a number of, rather unsavory, associations with people who've gotten into some legal trouble over their business ethics. So what does he do in response to these questions around his business practices and business ethics? He goes out and hires for his very first hire of his campaign for the Republican consultant who will run his campaign, a guy named Pat Shortridge, who in a previous life was a lobbyist for Enron. this strikes me as being a little tone deaf. But the other reason Shortridge is kind of fascinating character is he's also been a consultant for Marco Rubio, who is the Tea Party candidate in Florida, who has essentially forced Governor Charlie Crist out of the Republican Party. So this is very much going to be a battle to try and capture the energized Republican base this August, and it'll be very interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. One of the first things Rossi said as when he was announcing his campaign platform was an appeal to the Tea Partiers when he said, "I will not try to bring home any appropriations," which is, you know, what Patty Murray prides herself on, is that she has managed to get lots of money for special projects for the state of Washington. And as soon as I read that, Rossi was saying, oh, I think appropriations are evil. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to bring any money home for the state of Washington. I thought, okay, there goes major donors from the business community.
They're
going to contribute to Murray now.
Well, a number of the traditional major donors to Republican parties, like the Washington Association of Realtors and Boeing and a lot of those folks, are already in Murray's corner, which is why he felt it safe to make that announcement.
Yeah. But he's going to,
Murray
with
has
that
raised
announcement,
a huge amount of money from companies who she's done the bidding for over the years.
Yeah, and with that announcement, he's going to lose any support he might have had with, like, the Washington Builders Association, all those folks who
count on that.
Yeah, who tend to support, congressional earmarks for the state of Washington.
All right. Well, you mentioned Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell weighing in this week.
Yeah, rather surprising development. Not the overall vote that was surprising. There was an amendment to the defense appropriations bill this week in the Senate that would have imposed a timetable for withdrawal in the war in Afghanistan, and it got the support of very few Democrats, very few people total in the Senate. But both Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, to their credit, did vote in favor of it, so props to them for that. But overall, only 18 out of the 100 senators voted for a timetable for withdrawal for Afghanistan, so it looks like we're still going to be there for quite some time to come.
Yeah, and that's pretty amazing because, we really do need a timetable for withdrawal from Afghanistan. As Jav was mentioning before the show, we're seeing these special appropriations bills for money to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan after Obama promised he wouldn't do what the Bush administration not included in the defense budget, but to keep coming back to Congress with special emergency requests for funding. But he has to do that because the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are a deep financial black hole. Really, it's our second economic stimulus package is this money that's being appropriated to fund these wars.
Oh, instead of going to creating jobs or, benefits for the unemployed or anything like that. Or helping state budgets. It's going to, Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, exactly. Halliburton.
All right. Well, let's move to national and stick with the things related to the defense bill that happened this week.
Yeah, one other very positive development, and it's already now passed the House and still has to pass the Senate. Looks like Don't Ask, Don't Tell is on its way out the door finally after 17 long years and promises by the candidate Barack Obama to get it repealed. He has finally followed through on that apparently, or at least Congress looks like it will. Now you're seeing a pushback at the last moment by some Republicans and some leaders in the armed forces, although not the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to try and preserve Don't Ask, Don't Tell and keep gays out of the military. But a new poll this week shows that there is actually not very much support on this at all in the general public. In fact, attitudes toward gays in the military have changed radically since the imposition of Don't Ask, Don't Tell 17 years ago. Some 78% of Americans, including 85% of women, now think gays should be allowed to serve openly in the military. So there really isn't that much political downside to backing this, which is why you're seeing it pass as part of the appropriations bill in the House, which is what it did this week, and which is why even though the Pentagon says it still wants time to complete a study that it's doing of the ramifications of lifting the policy, you're eventually, sooner or later, and probably sooner rather than later, going to see an abolition of this policy.
Yeah. I want to talk about another amendment to the defense bill. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is the one that got all the press this week, but there was another one that was added to the, I believe it was the Senate version of the bill at the last minute. It directs the Pentagon's Inspector General to investigate lawyers for terrorism suspects if there's a, quote, reasonable suspicion, end quote, that they may have violated a Pentagon policy or interfered in some way with the operations of the prison camp at Guantanamo. Now, this amendment that directs the Inspector General to investigate the attorneys for detainees is just another way to intimidate lawyers that are seeking to represent some of the folks who have been held in indefinite imprisonment at Guantanamo. It's very, very vaguely worded. There's no way that an attorney would know all of the possible Pentagon policies that they might mistakenly violate at some point. And it's really meant to scare away these guys, many of whom are working pro bono. That's at no charge at all, in order to defend the civil rights of these folks who have just disappeared into the detainment system.
Yeah, and this in the context of yet again this week seeing another Guantanamo detainee being released by a tribunal, or was his release ordered by a tribunal because he was found completely innocent of any reason for being detained, even though he's been kept in a cage for the last 7 or 8 years.
All right. Moving on, developments with the oil spill.
Yeah, an update on the oil spill this week. It now is officially considered the biggest oil spill in history. Scientists have concluded that it is at least 2 times, if not 5 times, higher than the 5,000 barrels per day that the NOAA estimated, and that it's at least 12 to perhaps 20 times bigger than the original BP estimate of 1,000 barrels per day. And that so far about 30 million gallons of oil have spilled into the Gulf over 38 days.
That's about 30 million gallons.
Yeah, that's about triple what the Exxon Valdez spill was. Now, scientists from the University of Florida have also found a second underwater plume that is spreading northeast from the leak towards the continental shelf, and that's not only threatening parts of Louisiana, but it could eventually threaten coral reefs in the Florida Keys. At the same time, congressional investigators have been busy quizzing BP, looking at documents, etc., trying to discover what led up to the leak, to the accident. Investigators have found a document that shows that BP knew that the leak was larger from the first, that they had initially estimated that it was probably as large as 14,000 barrels per day, not the 1,000 barrels per day that they told the public and the government. So that I will leave you to decide whether that was outright lying or just a decision made in order to cover their behinds in case of a liability suit.
Yeah, there was also testimony this week that engineers on site on the rig before the original explosion that has led to the leak were arguing very strongly against the withdrawal of safety equipment that could have prevented the leak, and they were overruled by BP. So the BP very specifically has culpability for this leak, which it has been denying.
Not all the engineers on the platform at the time were BP employees. Some were employees of Transocean, and they were arguing for a more careful sealing of the well, and BP decided for economic reasons to use a cheaper and riskier method to close the well.
And of course, those economic reasons may yet pay off, because the other thing that BP has been doing, even as the water oil continues to spill into the Gulf, is they've had teams of lawyers working on trying to avoid financial accountability for this particular leak. This week, BP filed a motion in U.S. court to have all of the various lawsuits that have been launched against BP combined under one judge, and you'll never guess they actually have a specific request for who they think that judge should be. And the man's name, and you may want to make a note of this because he may be an important player as time goes on, U.S. District Court Judge Lynn Hughes, who is a Reagan appointee, which, you know, may or may not mean anything. Reagan appointees can certainly be impartial, but this one doesn't quite seem to fit that bill. He's taken trips all over the world, all expenses paid, to give lectures on ethics for the American Association of Petroleum Geologists. He owns a large portfolio of stock in most of the major oil companies in the world. And this is the man who swears up and down that he is impartial about hearing cases about the financial culpability of an oil company in the worst oil spill in world history. Now, this is somebody also who has made very favorable rulings to the oil industry in the past in some of his rulings, and this is why this is happening. But this is the sort of vigilance around the legal system that the Obama administration is going to have to fight very hard against. And so far, what's happening behind the scenes with the Obama administration is not quite as vigilant when it comes to offshore drilling, and when it comes to legal culpability for this disaster, as the public pronouncements might lead you to believe.
Yeah. I just want to point out that this is not the worst spill in world history. There have been worse spills, including a worse one in the Gulf. It was.
I thought it exceeded that one.
No, it hasn't exceeded that one yet, but it may if the leak continues. But it is certainly the worst spill in U.S. history anywhere in U.S. coastal waters or on land. So, it's looking like it's headed towards being the worst spill, at least in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, that was the Gulf of Ixtepec spill in, 1988 or something like that.
I think it was in the 70s. It was a Mexican rig.
Yeah, it was off the coast of Yucatan.
Yeah. But also I want to point out, too, that since the explosion, in spite of what Interior Secretary Ken Salazar and President Obama have said, the federal government has not stopped issuing permits for drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. The federal government has granted at least 19 environmental waivers and 17 drilling permits just for the Gulf region. Most of them are for...
Out of how many that's considered?
I don't know what the total number of permits considered are, but I'm guessing that it's probably 17 of 17 at the way the Mineral Management Service functions. But most of them are for deep water drilling, and some are for, get this, ultra deep water drilling. Four are for wells that would exceed the 1 mile deep drilling that was done on the Deepwater Horizon rig. They would be for wells that would be not 5,000 feet below the ocean surface, but 9,000 or more feet below the ocean surface, which just points out that we've exhausted all the easily accessible oil supplies in the continental U.S., and now we're just going to keep on going after the tough oil.
Yeah, and if you think it's hard to cap a gusher at 5,000 feet under the water, think of what it'd be like at 9,000.
Yeah, and you better believe there's no plan for how to do it.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the SEC proposed new rules this week on mark-to-market accounting. Mark-to-market accounting affects the way that banks value loans that are on their books. And in the past, banks have valued loans according to, well, most banks have valued the loans on their books according to what they think they will collect on that loan over time. Some people call that mark to make believe, but mark to market would require banks to value their loans at the market value of the loan if they were to try to sell it on the open market today, which means a lot of the loans on banks' books, particularly their real estate loans, would be valued at zero or just slightly above that. Now, the new rules would require banks to use those mark-to-market rules. This is going to be harder on small and mid-sized banks because a lot of big banks have already switched over to mark-to-market. So small and mid-sized or regional banks would be the ones that would have to take big write-downs on their real estate loans. There's a but on the other hand, it would be good news for investors and for people who want more transparency in the financial system, because we would finally be able to see for perhaps the first time the exact impact of the housing collapse on the financial system. But there's a fly in the ointment. Banks would be required to report the value of their loans not just at mark-to-market, but also at mark-to-make-believe. They would have to report the value both ways. And if there's a loss, then the loss can be split into two categories. Part of it can be posted against your earnings, and part of it can go against the book value of the bank.
Even though that means nothing.
Yeah, what it's doing is it's saying, well, you have to report your loans at their current market value, but if there's a loss, you can do your best to hide it. And the only people who will be able to figure it out are accountants who are trained in how to read these kinds of financial statements. So it really is, it's supposed to be a strike for transparency. It really is a strike against it.
All right. And related economic news coming out of the New York Times.
Good job.
Oh, yes.
Wake up.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hear economic. I think Maria, you know. Yeah, the New York Times last weekend actually committed an act of journalism, which had to do with the House Financial Services Committee. And you may wonder why is it so difficult to get Congress to regulate the financial services industry. This was kind of an illuminating vignette into it, and it had to do with the practices being done by the Democrats, although the Republicans, when they controlled Congress, were doing the same things. The Democrats are putting vulnerable freshmen in the House Financial Services Committee to make it easier for them to raise money for re-election. People who have been elected for the first time last time, who are running for re-election this time, are on average raising 56% more money for their re-election campaign if they're on the House Financial Services Committee.
And they're getting that money from where?
So it's working. And you can guess where they might be getting the money from. But what's particularly interesting is who tends to run for re-election in competitive districts. It tends to be more conservative districts and more conservative Democrats. So for that reason, you get the House Financial Services Committee skewed toward the more conservative members of the Democratic caucus, because they're the ones that the Democratic leadership wants to protect their seats. So you wind up with an ideological tilt toward the most conservative members of the Democrats, and probably toward the most establishmentarian members of the Republican Party as well, in order for power reasons, having nothing to do with public policy at all. But this is the consequence that you see for public policy, is that you wind up getting these policies that are very, very favorable to Wall Street.
All right. And briefly, international and Jamaica.
Yeah, Jamaica's been in the headlines lately, and folks might be scratching their heads going, what the heck is going on there, particularly with this gun battle in the Jamaican capital over what the Western media calls a drug lord, Christopher Koch. He's referred to as a drug lord, a gangster, a don, which makes him sound like a criminal. He is actually a businessman in Jamaica.
There's a difference?
That's what I'm about to tell you. There's really not much of a difference. He's a subcontractor of the Jamaican federal government. Because the Jamaican federal government doesn't supply any kind of infrastructure or services to much of the Jamaican populace, what they do is they give money to private businessmen to do that. And Christopher Koch has done that rather well in his neighborhood in West Kingston. He provides sewage treatment and water for the residents and garbage removal. And he also happens to provide other services for which there is a market in his neighborhood, including drugs and guns and prostitution. Well, we shouldn't
Rand be. Rand Paul's fantasy, in other words.
Yes, in other words, this is the sort of utopia that people like Sarah Palin and Rand Paul and other extremely conservative Republicans and quite a number of conservative Democrats would like to see in this country. So as you're watching these gun battles in Jamaica that are killing upwards of 100 civilians in the past 4 or 5 days, just keep in mind that that's what may be coming to a neighborhood near you.
All right, and very briefly, Afghanistan.
Yeah, if you ever wondered what Pravda could learn from modern U.S. media, there's an article this morning in the New York Times that pretty much gives an exemplary lesson. This is not just a Friday afternoon news dump. It's a Saturday morning on a three-day holiday weekend news dump. A scathing U.S. Army report issuing culpability for the killing of 23 civilians in Afghanistan in February to drone operators on an Air Force base in Nevada that were operating the drones at the time, who ignored ignored all of the signals that there were civilians in this party, and reported instead that it was all military age males, and therefore they wound up killing everybody in the party.
Many women and children.
Including,
right?
Many women and children. That's correct. And it was fairly obvious to the troops that first arrived on the scene from the brightly colored clothing that there were in fact civilians present. So it's one thing that this scathing report was done on a Friday afternoon news dump, but particularly interesting was the New York Times coverage of it, which spent the first paragraph describing the report and the next five paragraphs talking about how the U.S. goes to great lengths to prevent civilian deaths, and made no mention whatsoever of the fact that killing civilians is one of the main reasons why Afghan hearts and minds have turned against the U.S. in this war, and why we're losing this particular war, because it keeps happening. Very, very biased reporting by the New York Times on a story that was already dumped into one of the least visible time slots of the year.
All right, events.
Yeah, several Folk Life coming up this weekend, and there were, we talked earlier in the program about the various petitions that are trying to get on the ballot for November, in particular the Sensible Washington Marijuana Decriminalization Initiative is volunteer dependent at this point. They are not using paid signature gatherers, so if you want to volunteer for that, go to sensiblewashington.org/volunteer, and if you get a chance to sign up, please do. The same goes for I-1098, which will be out and around at Folk Life this weekend.
And I've been doing the Seattle International Film Festival and seen the signature gatherers for the I-1098, the Rich People's Tax Initiative, but I haven't seen any of the legalizing marijuana initiatives being passed around in line at the SIFF Films, and I think that should be done. So if you want to do that, go and volunteer.
Absolutely. So on Wednesday, June the 2nd, from 6:30 to 9:30, there will be a fundraiser for Iraqi Refugee Help. Jim Page and Mark Taylor Canfield, the Seattle Labor Chorus, reports back from refugee activists and silent and auction and all other kinds of good things. That'll be proceeds going to the Collateral Repair Project. It'll be at St. Patrick's Church, 2702 Broadway East on Capitol Hill. That's Wednesday at 6:30. And at the state, we have, at least we thought we had. It was up earlier this morning. We're probably still working on it. But we got our brand new website up and live this weekend. So check it out, www.eatthestate.org.